Good morning. Welcome to Movie Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm Rob Dillard. Today we welcome a new voice to the program. Filmmaker Andy Brody will be with us from Iowa City. We'll also have show regular Tom Beal from our studio in Ames. This time of year tends to be a slow time for new movie releases, but the upcoming season looks to be active with a slew of remakes and sequels. We'll spend a portion of the next hour talking about Hollywood's persistent desire to look toward the past for inspiration. But do we need a follow-up to Sex and the City? Do we need to revisit Elm Street and suffer through another nightmare? And we'll talk with Andy about his latest film project with musicians Greg and Pieta Brown. Stay tuned for Tom Beal, Andy Brody, and Movie Day on Talk of Iowa, following the news. Good morning. Welcome to Movie Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm Rob Dillard. Joining me this morning and making his first appearance on the show is Iowa City-based filmmaker Andy Brody. He regularly attends film festivals such as Telluride and South by Southwest, and he's currently working on a short film with musicians Greg and Pieta Brown and Bo Ramsey titled River Will Take You. Thanks for joining us this morning, Andy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is our resident movie critic and Iowa State University journalism professor, Tom Beal. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rob and Andy.
And if you would like to join our conversation about movies, please call 1-866-780-9100, or you can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Well, the 3D craze continues to draw huge audiences as director Tim Burton's wild take on the Alice in Wonderland story is packing cinemas nationwide. This version has a 19-year-old Alice falling down the rabbit hole. It stars Helena Bonham Carter, Johnny Depp, and Mia Wasikowska. And Tom, you've seen it. What do you think?
Well, first, I think we should clarify that while it is in 3D, it was not filmed in 3D. It was they used a process that allowed them to take a regular two-dimensional film and convert it to 3D, and therefore the 3D is not particularly impressive.
I was going to ask if it works.
I think it's a letdown, and certainly a dramatic letdown compared to Avatar, which was shot in 3D with 3D in mind. And it really makes a difference to see 3D as it was intended. And this, so it doesn't really add much to the movie. I think you could see it in a 2D form and you won't miss anything. Burton takes a fairly significant different approach to this story than the one we're used to from the wonderful animated Disney cartoon and other versions. This film is, or this story has been told in many ways. And so, on the one hand, Burton adds something to this story. And on the other hand, I have to say I wasn't too impressed. Depp does his thing, you know, he plays the Mad Hatter. And I'll say one little twist. I didn't see this in the animated version, and it may not be in the books, I can't remember. But the Mad Hatter, in this case, actually makes hats for the Red Queen, who is one wonders if she wasn't ingesting some of the chemicals that turn the Mad Hatter mad. But anyway, he makes a bunch of hats for her, and she models them and throws a bunch of them away. But it's a story of good and evil. There's a white queen in this story that that Alice wants to help restore control over the underworld instead of the Underland, I guess it's called. So long and the short of it is it's visually exciting. That is, lots of deep, rich colors and lots of action. There's a big war, a big battle scene, but then there was in the animated version as well. I'm not particularly impressed with the music. They don't have the wonderful Unbirthday song scene that I like so much from the animated version. All in all, they rounded up about every British actor they could find to do the voices. And so we have Martin Sheen, of course, is American. He plays he voices the White Rabbit. Stephen Fry, however, is British, plays the Cheshire Cat. Anne Hathaway is the White Queen. Helen Bonham Carter is the Red Queen, and other actors as well. from
brought in a lot of veterans from the Harry Potter series.
Well, yeah, exactly. Although I have to tell you, I didn't like it as well. Mm-hmm. I liked the Harry Potter series much better. This is a great story, and this is a unique story, a wonderful story of nonsense and truth and so on. So this is a different look at it. People seem to like it. The $208 million taken in so far. So it's certainly resonating with audiences. But I think the original or the 50s animated version is much more entertaining.
Andy, have you had a chance to catch it?
I haven't seen this one yet. I'm a little hesitant with Tim Burton's recent string of these kinds of films, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and now Alice in Wonderland, just because I feel like he's treading very familiar territory.
He was behind Sweeney Todd, too.
Right, yeah. So I feel like he sort of swung off in a direction of sort of doing some of these remakes or rehashes of older stories that with the same cast, the same stylistic kind of undertaking. And I'm more of a fan of his kind of older, more original work, which he's supposedly going to be doing some more of that on future projects here, which I'm looking forward to. But I think if you look at his filmography, his original, more original work like Beetlejuice or Ed Wood or Edward Scissorhands, much more interesting, really, than some of this more contemporary stuff that he's done.
Overall, what do you guys think of this move toward 3D? Is that the wave of the future? I know the upcoming Shrek, the animated film, is supposed to be in 3D. George Lucas is talking about a Star Wars in in 3D. There's another animated film called How to Train Your Dragon that's in 3D. A couple Tim Burton upcoming films are going to be in 3D, as is James Cameron's next big one. A lot of 3D being made.
Well, I think Spielberg has committed to it, as have some of the studios. The big holdup was who was going to pay to convert the theaters to run 3D. And that seems to have been worked out. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to split out, but the additional revenue seems to be an incitement for theater owners to make the change. As you know, when you go to a 3D movie, you pay at least a couple dollars more to see the film. You do get a nice heavy-duty pair of glasses, quite different from the flimsy paper things that we were given way back when. And the 3D technology is so much better. In the old days, when I was a kid working at a movie theater, you actually had to use both projectors to get the 3D effect. You had to run them simultaneously. They had to be synced perfectly. And one projected one color, one projected the other color, and then you wore the glasses and got this wonderful, and I think wonderful 3D effect. Some people got terrible headaches. And I'm told even today, with this single projector process, some people get headaches. But as I understand it, the technique is to alternate frames. So one frame is in one color from a slightly different angle. The other frame is in the other color from a slightly different angle. And by flashing them on the screen rapidly, your mind blends them using a technique called persistence of vision, and you get this wonderful 3D effect. So I think the key here is that the movie has to be conceived as a 3D movie, and that doesn't mean that you have to pop stuff out into the audience to make it work, but you have to have an idea that you're going to have levels, planes, I guess, of activity, so that the audience feels as if there's something more realistic about it. As I said, with Alice in Wonderland, there really wasn't anything happening there that made that particular story more interesting or more visually realistic. And so I think you have to start with the idea you're going to make it in 3D. I think it's the way to go. I think it's the thing that's going to save theaters, frankly. And it has, one would argue, it has a downside. There are some who argue that Avatar fared poorly at the Academy Awards because most of the Academy members saw the movie at home on a DVD and not in a theater where the full impact of the scale of the movie plus the 3D imagery could be felt, and they didn't see it, and therefore the picture probably looked disappointing to many of the Academy members.
Yeah. I have to say, I was wowed by Avatar more than I expected to be. Andy, what are your thoughts on 3D? In your own work, have you ever tried 3D, worked with it?
No, I haven't. I'm not really working on that level of budget, although the technology is becoming more affordable for independent filmmakers to try doing 3D, and there's some interesting work being done. German film director Wim Wenders was working on a ballet documentary in 3D, kind of, so on a kind of project that you wouldn't expect, not these sort of large Hollywood films like James Cameron would do or Steven Spielberg or George Lucas, but... I think, you know, Tom's right that James Cameron sort of raised the bar in terms of conceptualizing this project, Avatar, and he's been working on it for decades and kind of waiting for the technology to catch up. So the difference between a project like that and then just taking basically 2D films and processing them so they appear to have, you know, a few different planes dimensions is not the same thing. I guess my personally, I thought, you know, Avatar, while maybe sort of visually impressive as a film, left a lot to be desired. And I'm generally a film goer that is not as interested in the, you know, the technology as I am in the story or traditional cinematography, right? You know, I feel like if we go to an art museum, we don't need paintings to be in 3Ds or photographs to be in 3D. So I hope that while we're going to see more and more 3D, that kind of 2D cinematography doesn't go away. One thing that Avatar does is it's constantly directing your attention as a viewer. You know, look at this, look at that. You're not really allowed the freedom as an audience member to look at the frame and to pay attention to composition and framing and that a really talented filmmaker or cinematographer might allow you to do. And that's the kind of film that I sort of tend to favor. So, I'll be interested to see as we see 3D used in more less mainstream projects. But it's definitely the future. And Panasonic is working on 3D television sets. They just sold out a production line that they just released at Best Buy. They sold out. So that 3D technology is coming into the home, so that films like Avatar or these 3D projects can be viewed in a 3D way in the home environment as well. And that'll start to make that less special for movie theaters. I happen to think that if movie theaters want to stay relevant, then they really need to focus on providing a better viewing experience, meaning that have high technical standard without the cell phones and chatter and all of this that make it just kind of an annoying place to go.
Yeah, theater going would be great if you didn't have any customers in there.
Well, you know, the audience, it's great to see films with an audience, you know, and I'm very big supporter of that. And I'm a very big believer that how we see films affects our relationship with them. And one of the big reasons I fell in love with movies was movie going and cinemas and theaters themselves. So I would be sad to see that go.
We're going to have to take a short break. We'll pick up on those thoughts when we come back. 1-866-780-9100 or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's 10:19. Good morning. We're back on Talk of Iowa Movie Day. Andy Brody, filmmaker from Iowa City, is in our studio in Iowa City. Tom Beal, Iowa State University journalism professor, up at our studio in Ames, and I'm in the studio in Des Moines. So none of us are face-to-face today. Any other thoughts on what might improve the movie-going experience in theater plexes? Andy, you were talking about that before we went to break.
Well, I think, underscoring the social aspect of it, I always... use the analogy that, of course, it's cheaper to drink alone at home, but it's more fun to go out and drink with our friends or, you know, socialize in a tavern setting. So people kind of flock to that. Some of the art houses or nonprofit theaters around the country that are doing really well incorporate a food and drink element, the biggest being the Alamo Draft House in Austin, Texas, which is actually for-profit and shows fairly mainstream programming. Their sort of flagship theater does a lot of cult classics and special programming and events with visiting filmmakers and guest actors and interactive components. But they have, you know, alternating tables with rows where they serve you food and drink during the film. And it actually works really well. You'd think it would be very disruptive. But the same theater, they're very much proponent of, you know, don't talk during the movie, be respectful of your fellow audience members. And, you know, in fact, you raise a little flag if you're placing an order off the menu. You can do the same thing if there's a disruptive patron and they have that wait staff in there monitoring the show. So they will take care of that and, you know, ask someone to leave if need be. And really paying attention to that experience, making it a social outing, making it enjoyable so that it's worth your dollar. I mean, there's so many ways for people to see movies now. Whether aside from just DVD, you know, video on demand and streaming over the internet, that they're gonna, you have to do something to set that movie theater experience apart from the home. And I don't think it's just 3D. I mean, I think that's part of it. And new technologies have always been used by Hollywood to try to entice audiences back in, you know, into the theater when they felt like, you know, television or other things may draw people away. So, but really, I think it's just creating a space which people can come together and enjoy a film as an audience. And I don't get that too much when I go to the multiplex. It's usually, you know, more annoying and unenjoyable, which pains me. But when you do get a chance to see something with an audience and you're all really into it, it's a really special thing. And so I would like to see more of that.
Well, I managed the movie theater when I was a teenager in the 50s, believe it or not. And in those days, we didn't have multiplexes. Each theater had a separate screen, and we rarely had more than one screen in a theater. The theaters in downtown were very large, and you had it was a real experience. They were ornate. You felt like you were going to a kind of a palace or something, the People's Palace. And the little neighborhood theaters had some conveniences that are long since gone. They had, I remember very clearly, cry rooms, and that's where mothers with small children could go and sit. They could hear the movie. They had a big window they could look through. It was a separate room, usually up in the balcony. And they could, the kids could make all the noise they needed to, and the parents could still watch the movie, more or less. And it wasn't disturbing the other people in the audience. Of course, theaters were very inexpensive then, and you could get a bag of popcorn very cheaply. I even adjusted for inflation. There's no question that the concession prices are rather high. On the other hand, that's how the theaters survive, since they have to contribute so much of the revenue to pay for the film that they're showing. I am really intrigued by the fact that despite all the competition for people's attention, movie-going attendance is still hanging in there. It's down a bit from previous years, but the increased admission prices seem to have kept the revenue about the same. And here we are in a recession where many people don't have jobs or on limited income, and just as in the Great Depression, people are turning out in large numbers to see the films that they want to see. And they stay away from the films they don't want to see. And those are the ones, of course, that pull the whole operation down a bit. But if you go to a theater with 12 screens, you're apt to find at least one movie that you want to see that hasn't been sold out. And so you can always get in. In the old days, you could go to a theater and get in line and discover that the last ticket's been sold and you have no movie.
Before we move on, I want to read an email that has arrived from Jessica. She says, I loved Alice in Wonderland. I love how Tim Burton uses vivid colors, and I love the different take on the characters. She says when she sees the beginning of an advertisement or a movie trailer that about a film that she knows she really wants to see, she closes her eyes, puts her fingers in her ears, goes la 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 la, so she doesn't hear it. So she doesn't have any preconceived expectations of that movie when she finally sees it. So thanks for that email, Jessica.
You know, she's put her finger on an interesting point, and that is the previews tend to give away too much of the story. I don't know why.
Oh, my goodness,
but
yes.
They'll show you what the ending is. If you watch carefully, you can see how the movie's going to turn out. And why they feel they need to do that, I don't know.
I used to love trailers. I go early just for the trailers in many cases. But they are telling too much of the story now.
Many of them are, right.
Yeah, yeah. Another film I know you've seen, Tom, is Green Zone with Matt Damon. It's another Iraq War movie. Teams him with his Bourne Supremacy director, Paul Greengrass. It cost nearly $140 million to make, and in its first weekend, it really tanked.
Well, that's right. I think it was a New York Times story that said this could be the first bomb of the year. It's interesting, though, that it did come in second for the week. It took in $14.5 million, as you mentioned, and it still was enough to place it in second place. Of course, it's ahead of some films that were made for far less money, and Avatar is still hanging in there, making quite a bit. Well, I wanted to talk about Green Zone. Much as, for some reason, the reviewers are using this as a club against the previous administration at Universal Studios. They were thrown out just as this movie was about to be released, and they were faulted for green lighting this picture. Well, this is a picture that really confronts some fundamental questions about the war. And it does it in a very exciting way. I suppose that's how you manage to irritate both two groups of people, those who think the war was a patriotic thing and we should do it, and those who criticize the war. Because this movie does go right to the heart of the question, where were these weapons of mass destruction? And it focuses on a chief warrant officer played by Matt Damon, who's with a crew, and they're sent to specific sites to uncover or to take into the custody these weapons of mass destruction that they've been told exist. And when they get there, there's nothing there. And ultimately, the story unfolds that this is a big cover-up that a source has given intelligence people a list of where all these UMDs are, and in fact, they never existed. And the question we're not quite sure is whether the source lied or whether, in fact, the information the source gave them was true, but that people in power manipulated the information in order to justify the war. Well, that theme, of course, is going to irritate a lot of people. But the story itself is visually incredible. I mean, they may have spent $140 million on it, but you do see it on the screen. They recreated Baghdad in Morocco and Spain, and sure, I thought maybe it was the real thing because of the way you see the buildings that you saw in newsreels and things. It's really a fast-moving, exciting story. I think because of the political theme, though, it has irritated people. But why this movie is being criticized so heavily another movie that didn't get any viewers either, The Hurt Locker, isn't. Now, true, they made that for $1.50, and of course it went on to win the Academy Award, but I haven't seen it because it came and went before I could even get to the theater where I wanted to see it. But as I understand it, it does not confront the issues. It's more a matter of the bravery of these men who go out and defuse these bombs, whereas this story is really going right at the heart of this whole question of why are we in Iraq? Why did we commit ourselves to a war based on the idea that Iraq had these incredible weapons, only to discover they didn't have them, and that here we are all these many years later still embroiled in this thing, and we're kind of stuck at, like, we're in the briar patch. We can't get out of this thing.
All right, Tom, we'll pick up with our conversation about movies in about 5 minutes after a break. Andy Brody and Tom Beal, stay close to the mics. We'll get back to you in just a few minutes. We'll get to your email comments as well following the break. I'm Rob Dillard. Good morning. We're back on Talk of Iowa, Movie Day. My guest, Andy Brody, a filmmaker in Iowa City, and Tom Beal, our regular movie critic up in Ames. I'm Rob Dillard. Before we continue our conversation, I want to get to a couple of emails. This from Jeff in Rock Island, Illinois. He's a geographer who has spent countless hours as an undergraduate in college working with a stereoscope, which is a device with two clear lenses next to each other to see photographs in 3D. He says he feels the ability to use something like a stereoscope would create the best possible 3D movie experience. Thanks for that, Jeff. And also, this is from David Leonard in Waukee. He says he saw The Hurt Locker after it won all the Academy Awards and was very disappointed. The experience was anything but the unrelenting tension he had read about in reviews. He was actually quite bored for periods of time and nearly nodded off a time or two. He's willing to suspend disbelief, but the main character was so reckless that he wasn't believable, and thus I didn't care about him. I have to really care about film characters to like the film, and he didn't care about any of them in that movie. I heard the exact same thing at a dinner party last weekend from a whole bunch of my friends. So there's a mixed reaction on The Hurt Locker.
Well, I don't think our listener would be disappointed if he saw The Green Zone. There is a lot of action. It's got substance. And incidentally, it was photographed by the same man who shot The Hurt Locker, but he obviously had millions of dollars more money to use to create this world in Iraq there at the beginning of the war.
Andy, any films out there that you've seen lately or are looking forward to seeing?
excuse me. Well, I can recommend a couple of things that may be difficult to see in theaters around here. Although I think maybe Michael Haneke's new film, The White Ribbon, may be playing in Des Moines.
It hasn't opened yet. Okay, it's on the schedule to open at the Fleur Theater soon.
I did see that one this year at Telluride and would highly recommend it. That's another project that was in development for quite a long time.
It's a German film, right?
It's in German. It's set in northern Germany before a small village before World War I. Michael Haneke is Austrian himself, but it's shot in black and white. It's absolutely stunning cinematography, and it took him the better part of a decade to be able to produce that film. Talking about James Cameron's efforts with Avatar earlier, but for very different reasons.
What is the name again?
It's called The White Ribbon.
And can you tell us what it's about?
Sure. Well, it's set in, as I said, in a small village, German village, before World War I, and dealing with some issues this community and the family is facing. If you've seen other films by Michael Haneke, his films can be kind of violent, sort of heavy and oppressive. But he says about The White Ribbon that it's dealing with the origin of every type of terrorism, whether it's political or religious in nature. So just talking about Green Zone or The Hurt Locker, which I think deals more with the psychology of maybe our addiction to war or, why we're kind of drawn to it. That's at least, I think, their intention with The Hurt Locker. The screenwriters talked about that. He's a former journalist covering those units. And then Catherine Bigelow talking as the director. That was kind of the thing she was seeking. So The White Ribbon is kind of complex, but with these different characters, the main character is a village school teacher, and dealing with this Protestant village, these religious themes, without going into the plot too much. But it's just very well done, very well directed, really great performances by some of the young child actors in the film.
I believe it was one of the Academy Award Best Foreign Film nominees.
It was.
Am I right?
Yeah, it was nominated for it was Germany's submission for Best Foreign Language Film, which that caused a little bit of criticism since Haneke's an Austrian director. Mm-hmm. But it's a German language film.
But it's all Europe now.
Yeah, well, yeah. So anyway, I would highly recommend that. Also, the French film called A Prophet by Jacques Audiard is a French gangster film that's very good.
That, too, is on the schedule to open at the Fleur here in
okay,
Des Moines
great.
Soon.
And I think those films, too, are probably in Iowa City at some point come to the Bijou Theater, the student-run cinema on campus. So I would encourage people to check those out later on down the road if they don't have a chance to see them in theaters. But I think they'll hopefully come to the Ames, Des Moines area in Iowa City at some point here.
You mentioned it took 10 years to get that White Ribbon film made, and I'm reminded of some Orson Welles projects that dragged out over years. And he would start shooting, and then years would pass, and he'd shoot some more. And, of course, the people would begin to age and look different.
Right. Right.
I guess you cover that all in post-production or something.
Yeah, it can be difficult. I know projects can take a long time to come to fruition, so that's interesting. I mean, and then we were talking about remakes earlier, and, you know, some directors have remade their own films, I guess. Hitchcock himself remade one of his films and just felt like, you know, he was a better director and in a better position to make a film later in
and
his
he
career.
And he had more money, too.
Yeah, and more money. And Michael Haneke is a director who remade his film Funny Games, did an English version language a couple of years ago, sort of a shot-for-shot remake, but with American actors and English. So that's interesting.
I was thinking before we talked about remakes and sequels, we might want to talk about Shutter Island for a moment, which I think you saw, Andy.
I will. Let me first get the phone number out, 1-866-780-9100, or you can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's do go to Shutter Island. It's based on a Dennis Lehane novel, which usually means good things, and his books were the basis for Mystic River and Gone, Baby, Gone. This one is a Martin Scorsese film.
Well, Andy, did you not say you saw it?
No, I have not,
I'm sorry.
No.
I thought you had. Well, I did see it, it's taken in $108 million, so it's doing pretty well. I don't know what it costs to make. This is the fourth time that Leonardo DiCaprio and the director have worked together. And Scorsese's interesting take on this story. It's a very gloomy story, very moody. It's two FBI agents, or marshals, pardon me, they're U.S. marshals, Leonardo DiCaprio and his partner Chuck Owl, played by Mark Ruffalo, go to this island there near Boston, and it's an island that has I guess at one time was a prison or something during the Civil War, and now treats mentally ill criminals. And they're called to the island because a child murderer has gone missing. They don't know what happened to this person, a woman. And so they launch an investigation. The story has many twists, and by the time you get to the end of the picture, it's really hard to know what's true and what isn't. But in the way, along the way, it really does, I think, grab you by the throat and pull you along. You're just never quite sure what's going to happen next. It's a psychological story, very gloomy, as I say. It has a wonderful cast. Besides DiCaprio and Ruffalo, there's Ben Kingsley playing one of the doctors. Max Van Sydow is also one of the doctors. Michelle Williams, Jackie Earle Haley, Ted Levine, and so on, all making up the cast of Shutter Island.
Let's talk about some of the sequels and the remakes that are coming up in the months ahead. We started talking about a remake of Alice in Wonderland that has been made many times, the most famous being the 1951 version Walt Disney produced, but it's been on TV and stage and everywhere else over years. Coming up this summer, we've got Iron Man 2, another film that stars Robert Downey Jr. is on the docket.
And
for
Mickey
the summer.
Rourke is in it if people want to see how Mickey's doing. And this is they're running the previews already now, and the previews are pretty impressive. Remember, the first one got good reviews in part because it was a different take on the superhero thing, and Downey did a wonderful job. Will this thing do as well? Will it be as well done? Will it have as much substance? Ah, there's the question. That's the question with every sequel. But that's only one of several coming out that the people recognize. Clash of the Titans. Ray Harryhausen made a film using stop-motion animation back in the 50s, and now with all the special effects available to the filmmakers, they've redone it, and it looks like it's going to be visually pretty dynamic. There's another Nightmare on Elm Street coming out in April, at the end of April. If you're into
I'm not sure I need to see that.
I'm not a big and the one I think the, one of the most interesting things coming out. It'll be released in the mid May. Is another version of Robin Hood, and this is a much darker version than the one that we remember from 1938. For those who've seen that great color movie, this one is directed by Ridley Scott and stars Russell Crowe, Kate Blanchett, Matthew McFadden, and It's about Robin, who travels to Nottingham toward the end of the 12th century. Of course, that's the time it's set. And there's the sheriff, played by McFadden, and nasty, evil guy. And you've got Blanchette playing the Maid Marian and so on. And so the same general story, but it looks from the previews to be a completely different take on it. Now, will it be, one we like? I don't know. It's a story that's been very durable. I mean, Sean Connery played Robin as an older man. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yes.
And I didn't care for it.
That was really a good version. I actually liked that one.
I just didn't like the... I love Sean Connery. Didn't like the idea of seeing Robin, who is this young, energetic guy, as an older man and all the things that he had to face. Another Shrek is coming out on May 21st. There's a remake, as you mentioned earlier, of Sex and the City. With the same television crew there. There's a remake of The Karate Kid. Do you remember that film?
Yeah.
And Jackie Chan is going to be the judo master. Toy Story 3 is coming out in June. Tom Hanks, Tim Allen, here's the plot. It's kind of interesting. In this case, we've got... the boy who these toys belong to is going off to college. And so the toys are dumped at a daycare center. And who will they survive, I wonder? The Twilight Saga, another episode of that series. I've seen the first two, and I still don't know what the attraction of vampire movies are. And The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Now, remember, Disney made that famous scene from Fantasia, The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Well, this is the live-action version coming out in mid-July with Nicolas Cage. This is a sorcerer leaves his workshop in the hands of his apprentice, who gets into trouble when the broomsticks he's tasked to do his chores for him somehow develop a mind of their own. Okay, from Disney, incidentally. But this, as I understand it, is live action, I believe. So we'll have to see how that turns out.
Let's bring in a phone call. Jerry, I believe, is on the line. Jerry, go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. How you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Yeah, hi. My wife and I own the Bijou Movie Theater in Mount Vernon, Iowa, north of Iowa City. And interestingly enough, we sometimes get some of the independent films that were intended for the Bijou Movie Theater in Iowa City.
What, did they get confused and delivered to the wrong theater?
Yes, sometimes they do.
Oh, I wonder.
Yeah, I was the programming director at the Bijou at UI, and yeah, we would occasionally get the prints sent to the wrong location.
I'm a veteran of the Bijou, too.
Okay, yeah.
I worked there in the late 70s.
Yep.
Oh, good. But anyway, I guess my comment is that I've seen Avatar in 3D, and I've seen it at our little theater too, and in regular 2D, and I guess I don't see the allure of the 3D format. I think it's been way oversold personally. Just a general comment. The other side to it is that obviously we're still using 35mm print as our media. We've actually, looked at trying to go digital, just because of our concerns with getting content, movies. The studios certainly don't seem to be on at least on our end, willing to help us out or to even direct us to get that conversion done.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, unfortunately, you're an independent operator, so you don't matter as much to them as the Regals or the AMCs of the world, where they want to, that's who they're kind of in partnership with. And that's a challenge, really, for small theaters like yourself to spend significant amounts of money, tens of thousands of dollars on these digital 3D systems that are only going to keep outpacing themselves. That's also the trick of this. 35mm projection has basically remained unchanged in the, over 100 years of film projection. The film projectors have been relatively unchanged. But once we go to digital, we're talking about 2K resolution, 4K resolution, 3D technologies. And those things are going to keep evolving. And who's going to continue to foot that bill is an interesting question. I don't know what to tell you. I know the new Strand Theater in West Liberty, they made the decision to go digital, and I don't know how that's worked for them, playing a lot of family-friendly stuff and doing the 3D, but it's quite expensive. So
It's somewhere around $80,000 to $120,000 is my current.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
And there's no real financial incentive. As I understand it, some of the larger chains have been nearly bankrupted by the debt they've had to incur from going all digital on all of their screens. So it's an interesting dilemma.
You know, you remind me that theater chains and even the studios, some of them got into deep trouble when they converted to sound. And the cost that entailed. And I reminded back when I was a kid in the 50s when theaters were converting to CinemaScope. They had to put in wider screen and the lens. They had to buy a lens that would anamorphic lens. And I remember this little neighborhood theater cost $5,000, and the owner said, "I don't know how I'm going to make this pay this," because he that was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. In 1950-something.
Jerry, thanks for your call. Next time I'm in Mount Vernon, I'll stop by.
Great, thank you.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
Before we run out of time, and we're coming up with about 5 minutes left in the program, I wanted to ask Andy about the film he's working on right now. He's working with three of my favorite musicians in Iowa, Greg and his daughter Pieta Brown and Bo Ramsey. What's going on with that?
Well, it's a project. It's a short narrative film that I've been working on for a couple of years, developing now, which sounds like a long time for a short film. But same way, we're shooting this project on film, on Super 16mm film. So I'm working with the cinematographer who's real experienced in that format. We're shooting it mainly at a couple of historic Iowa locations. One being the Sutliff Bridge in the tavern there. Here in rural Johnson County, which was flooded in 2008, and part of that bridge is missing, of course, and we're dealing with the issue of rebuilding now in Johnson County. And then the other location is the Reed Nyland Corner, which is an old motel and cafe on the original Lincoln Highway in Colo, Iowa, over in Story County, that's been restored and is really quite nice. They've had some struggles trying to make it work financially, but they did invest a lot of money in restoring the location. It's where the original Lincoln Highway and Jefferson Highway intersected there in Colo. So the film is actually stars Greg in an acting role, playing an older musician crossing the state, kind of returning to his roots and looking for the source of some photographs and kind of coming back to an important place from his past. Pieta is also playing a role in the film, and Bo will be doing an original score for the film. So this will be around a 20-minute project, and we're getting ready to shoot the film in a couple of months now. In May, we'll be shooting it, and I'll be doing post-production work throughout the summer and doing a premiere next fall, and followed by festival screenings, and working on in the early stages of planning a tour of some historic, talking about movie theaters, we're going to do a tour of some historic Iowa movie theaters, single screen theaters that are still open around the state, maybe 10 or 12 locations all over the state. That'll probably be next spring. So, the film is called River Will Take You, and my website's andybrody.com for people who might be interested in more details. They can go to my website and read about the film and the cast and crew, and we've been doing a fundraising, kind of a grassroots fundraising. It's really hard to find money for independent projects, let alone short films. So I've been doing a grassroots fundraising campaign that's gone pretty well and still pushing that. So there's information about that as well on my website if people are interested.
Is it tough to get festivals to pay attention to films like that?
There are a lot of short film programs, and there are a few really large festivals that are dedicated to short films. Palm Springs in California, Aspen Shorts Fest in Colorado, DC Shorts in Washington, DC. My last short film was a 9-minute black and white silent shot on Super 8 film. It premiered at the Sarasota Film Festival in Florida, which is a really big and growing regional festival that has really great programming. They have features and shorts. So I think it's hard when you're completely independent if you're submitting your DVD blindly to a festival that receives hundreds or thousands of entries. The chances of getting in aren't so great. You know, it's a lot of times it helps to know producers or people that work with the festival and try to get them to take a serious look at your film. But I have pretty high hopes for this project. I think it's pretty likely to play at some big festivals. And my last film played at over a dozen festivals across the U.S. and in Europe, so I had pretty good successes with that.
I might give a plug for the Cedar Rapids Independent Film Festival,
sure, yeah,
which is coming up April 9th and 10th, just a few weeks away.
Yep, it's a great local fest. I've screened work there, and they really do a lot to support Iowa filmmakers. So it's definitely worth checking out to see some local work.
Tom, as you looked ahead to the upcoming movies, anything that really makes you want to head to the cinema this summer or this spring?
You know, there are several previews promoting upcoming films that look pretty exciting, but do you think I can remember any of them? But I wanted to mention just the loss of Peter Graves and Corey Haim. More Peter, I guess. Peter Graves.
We just have about 30 seconds, but yeah,
well,
go ahead.
You'll remember him from Airplane and
what fabulous.
What a role. and so he left us, and Corey Haim was only 36 when he died of unknown causes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, thanks for mentioning that, Tom. Tom Beal, thank you for, as always, being part of Movie Day on Talk of Iowa. Andy Brody, it's been nice talking with you, and nice to have a chance to meet you.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Take care.
You too.
See you, Rob.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese with production assistance today from Jeff Schmidt, John Pimble, and Jonathan All. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about the program. Contact us anytime by going to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Rob Dillard. Thanks for listening.